VorpalNetwork.com.
This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
I'm Chris Perkins. I'm a leap year baby.
Chris is 10 today.
That's right. And your friendly Canadian, I'm here and with The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 146. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I have set my minions far and wide through the floor of Gen Con to bring you interviews! Helping me with this episode is Quinn Murphy from At Will, Mike Shea from Sly Flourish, and the crew of Fistful of Comics and Games. We talked to Mike Merles, Rodney Thompson, and Rich Baker. Some of them we talked to more than once, but in different combinations, and the last one, which is the one that has repeat interviewees, was done after the announcement about future products on Saturday morning, so we could ask different styles of questions. Let's talk about our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games, before we get into these interviews, however. Noble Knight will buy your old game books, sell you out-of-print games, and bring you all the latest and greatest in RPGs that just came out. My pick for this episode is the new Dungeons & Dragons comic book from IDW, a well-known publisher of comics. Issue number 0 is out, giving a preview of what the new comic book series is going to be all about. And you can get it for under a dollar from Noble Knight. I know I read it and enjoyed it, and I'm certainly going to be giving the latest incarnation of a D&D comic a shot. Check out the show notes for links.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
And now it's time for the interviews. First up is Mike Shea and Quinn Murphy talking to Mike Merles about, well, a bunch of stuff. Let's give it a listen.
This is Mike Shea and
Quinn Murphy.
We're both here for The Tome Show, and we're talking with Mike Merles and
Laura Thomas.
And Laura. So I think today we're going to talk a lot about essentials, and we also want to talk about some of the future of the past and the future of D&D and how it's progressed over the past 2 years and how you guys see it progressing over the next 2 years. So to start off, where is Essentials targeted? Who did you kind of write Essentials for? Who did you build it for?
So Essentials really has two target audiences. It started out very much focused on people who would be new to D&D. So one of the things we started out with, process started last September, essentially breaking down, looking at 4th edition, looking at D&D as a whole, and thinking of what are like the most iconic elements of D&D, like on the story end, what are the things that make people want to play D&D, and then looking at the mechanical end, what are the mechanics that we can do within the 4th edition to make it as easy as possible for new players to come into the game. And really it's about having that grasp of like, if I take mechanic A, what does it mean in the world, you know, the world of D&D. So as the work progressed on it, what we found was we could make a product that, with the essentials, especially the Player's Essentials books, Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms and
Heroes of the Fallen Lands.
I always get the titles changed several times, so I always the title last year was this. But so what we found was, like, for the Red Box, for instance, that's really aimed at new players. You know, if you're an existing D&D player, it's got a good nostalgia factor. Like, if you played with Red Box back in the day, Larry Elmore art. But if you're an existing 4th edition player in a current campaign, there's really not anything new there for you. But what we did in the Player's Essentials books was create essentially new builds for existing core classes. Because what we didn't want to do was create brand new character classes for new players, because that would kind of go against the core of D&D. Like, D&D is fighters and wizards and clerics and rogues. We didn't want to go, okay, you're new to D&D, here's the core of D&D, and it's some group of new classes. So we had to resolve was a sort of a new mechanical structure for new players, but it's also, since it's new and interesting, but it fits within the current structure, something that older players may look at and find interesting. So, for example, you look at the fighter, the knight, with his stances. it's a different type of power. Instead of having at-will attacks, the fighter chooses a stance. For example, you get a +2 bonus to damage with their basic attacks. But most of the knight's attacks are basic attacks. And that's basically derived from this idea that if for a new player, things like powers, it's pretty easy to grasp the idea of a spellcaster using a power. If you're a wizard, you're going to cast Fireball, you're going to think, okay, that's a power, that's a spell, it's a discrete thing that I've learned, and I cast it to throw a Fireball at somebody. It's a little more difficult in terms of martial classes for some new players. Not all. Some people could grok it pretty easily. For some people, it seems a little strange to think of your attack, swinging your sword, as a power. There's different ways you can swing your sword. You know, a lot of times when I'd be teaching new players, they just want to, they just say, okay, there's an orc in the room. What do? Well, I run up next to him and I attack him. Do you use Tide of Iron? Do you use Sly Flourish? what attack do you want to use? So a thing like a stance for a fighter or the rogue's tricks, which are basically move actions and then give you an augmentation to your basic attack, they're a little bit easier for a new player to understand. You're playing a rogue, or you're playing a thief, you're a very tricky guy, you're cunning, so you're going to do a trick, use a trick to set up your enemy and then make an attack. If you're a fighter, you're going to go into a different fighting stance. If you've played some different types of fighting games, or if you've studied martial arts, or if you just, kind of have the sense, okay, my stance, depending on how I hold my weapon and what, if I'm really offensive, holding back defensive, it's easier for a new player to understand. And also have the side benefit of, that's a new mechanic for an existing 4th edition player to check out, and okay, this is why I want to buy this book, here's some new mechanics. The key is it all works together. It's still 4th edition. Powers are interchangeable across the classes. So, for example, fighter utility powers, regardless of what type of fighter you are, you can take a utility either from essentials, from existing things. And we're still supporting pre-essentials classes going forward. There's going to be a Warlord article, a new build that for the Warlord that integrates well with the essentials classes since he uses a lot of basic attacks. I think that's coming out in October or November in Dragon. So it's still all D&D. It's not like it's not a new addition or a fundamental change in how the game works.
Okay, so
can I just add a little thing? There's another group of people that we think are going to find the Essentials line very appealing, and that's people who used to play D&D back in the day but aren't currently engaged with the brand because their lifestyles have changed. And so this line is going to make it, we believe, a lot easier for them to get back in, whether they start with the Red Box, which is a great place to start, the new starter set, or the Player Essentials or whatever. Lower price points, I feel like they're easier to consume chunks of content. And there's a much very clear migration path from product to product. If you start with the starter set, people identify right at that point, usually, am I going to be more of a player or a DM? We provide, the actual stepping stones within that product of the player's essentials path that you would follow for the lion, or the DM's essentials from the lion as well. So there's a huge audience out there that just haven't been playing. This is a great opportunity for them to get back in and get up to speed with any changes that may have happened with regards to the rules, maybe since they had played the last time.
So, I wanted to sort of play off what you were mentioning with the integration kind of thing, because I think that's one of what I observe sort of something that's a concern for people. Mm-hmm. How well is this going to integrate? How, if I start with essentials and then I find a normal, regular play group, hardcore group, and then I take my knight and I bring it in, is it going to look weird in there? How's it going to look at that table integrated?
So what you would see in that case, the fighter is going to use slightly different mechanics in terms of his powers. Mm-hmm. He's going to have stances instead of at-wills. But the way, one of the nice things about 4th edition is since we have a sort of a math system, the backbone, like how much damage we expect the average character at level Y to do, we just sculpt the knight. So even though he's not using, for example, daily attacks, his at-will and his encounter damage make up for that. So if you were to just sit down, say, a regular fighter, a Player's Handbook 1 fighter, and a knight, and march a bunch of orcs into them. Two first level characters and an endless stream of orc minions. They would both chop through the same number of minions before either they were defeated or the encounter was over. Their ACs are relatively the same. The knight, though, gets plate mail, so he's a little bit more, a little bit better at being a defender in that sense. But their attack damage, when you add up their dailies, their encounters, and their at-wills, is the same. I mean, obviously there's still variation in what feats a player takes, what magic items and stuff. There's still place to build your character. But the really nice thing is we can take that math. Since we know the endpoint, we can just break down the math so that a different equation, if you will, produces the same endpoint. You can almost think of it as it's like algebra. In one case, it's like 2x plus 2y plus 1z equals 10. We know it has to equal 10, so we can just change what x, y, and z equal, or we can just change the multipliers. Well, this is, 3x plus 4y, and there's no z, but it still equals 10, whatever the combination is. So the character plays a little bit differently. And that's really the key, is we wanted the characters to play a little bit differently. We wanted to make the player characters, the character classes, feel more vividly different in play, and especially how the players think of them in terms of, like, okay, I'm a rogue, I'm going to use tricks. I'm a wizard, I have to think of the schools of magic I want to specialize. I'm a cleric, what domain am I falling? What god? Making that very vivid. So to really, at the end of the day, a player who is coming to D&D without any preconceived notions, or like someone who played D&D in like 1984 or something like that, if they just think in terms of story, the game maybe makes more sense to them. You know, I kind of think the Player's Handbook, if you think kind of mechanics first, really speaks to that sort of mindset. Whereas Essentials speaks more to story first. You just think, hey, it'd be cool to play a cleric of Thor, so I'll make a guy with, I'll make a human cleric, I'll take the Storm Domain, and I'll pick up the Warhammer as my weapon. Now I'm playing a guy who feels like a cleric of Thor. You know, things like that.
So the Essentials line is 10 products right now. Is the Essentials line going to be a continuing product beyond 10, or is 10 going to be the set amount of products for the Essentials?
It's evergreen.
Right.
It's meant to be easier for retailers just to know that if I don't have any other D&D SKUs on the shelf, which we hope they will,
right,
they always at least have these 10 SKUs.
Okay.
And they'll always live on the shelf. And then we'll continue to release, you know, other frontless product over time as people get more advanced and whatnot. But those 10 SKUs are it for now.
And these are all paperback products right now?
No, there are some box products as well.
Okay. The Essentials line has hardback products, or
no box products,
and
trade paperbacks for the books.
Is the D&D line overall going to be going to the trade paperback, or is it sticking with the or going back to hardback?
No, there will be frontless product that is hardcover.
There'll be what?
There will be frontless product going forward.
Gotcha.
That is hardcover.
Gotcha.
But the Essentials has 6x9 trade paperbacks,
right,
and some box products, some dice product as well, some tile products.
Is the PHB 1, Monster Manual 1, and DMG staying in print?
Yes, they'll be in the market for the foreseeable future.
Right.
I can't speak to current ones because I'm not involved in that.
Okay.
But they're out there. They're we continue to support them. To Mike's point, they're completely compatible with Essentials, and
right,
they'll be out there for the foreseeable future.
Right.
And like mentioned earlier, we have like the Warlord article slated, mm-hmm, for Dragon. I think it's either October or November. I can't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that. I mean, there's the important thing is when you look at the compendium, you know, they're still part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
So will we be seeing like a lot more sort of that central friendly, starting with the Warlord?
So I think I don't know the exact details of the article yet. It's still,
mm-hmm,
something that's, you know, it's in process. But I think what we're looking at is something where it's not a change to the Warlord. It's just the Warlord as it is in the PH1, new powers. But maybe powers, it's a build that speaks like, you know, more to like characters using basic attacks. You can
okay,
say, okay, I'm a Warlord playing in a party with a Knight and a Slayer. What powers should I be taking? Okay, here's some powers that speak directly to basic attacks. These are good powers to take. So, things like that. But it's not changing the Warlord. It's just new powers that a new Warlord can take. So.
What's your general philosophy on power creep throughout the game? As more and more options become available with each new product that's coming out, it seems like the ability to bring combinations of these things together in new and interesting ways. Like, how do you feel when you look at the character optimization boards? And what are your thoughts about how you can react to it?
So there's really two ways to look at it. Like you said, obviously, if you add more options are power.
Right.
If there's more things to choose from, it's just more combinations you can find. We never intend for power creep. The only time we do something like that is if we look at a class or a race and feel this isn't clocking in where it should be. There might be something in the metagame or just how we think how the game's being played. We thought this would be really powerful. It turns out it's not as powerful as we thought. And that might be where we might boost something a little bit. Because we don't want people to have classes that are just like, oh, nobody plays the bard because it's just too weak. We don't want that. What's the point of printing that class? So with the character optimization boards, it's kind of this. My attitude toward it is, on one hand, I think that's kind of it's almost like a game within D&D. It's,
mm-hmm,
like a game people play. And you kind of want to have people going through and finding. You don't want them to find combinations that make the game boring or unfun, but it's sort of fun saying, well, I'm going to see what kind of character I can make who's really powerful. You know, to me, it's kind of almost like tuning a deck in Magic, or if you're building your Warcraft character, getting the right mix of gear, or like a Warhammer army, what's the good combination between this unit and that unit? So you want some element of that. We just want to make sure that if it's something that goes beyond the pale of what we consider sort of the acceptable range of power. I kind of mentioned before this idea of this algebraic equation, you know, x plus y plus z equals 10. If someone's making that equal 20, then maybe we have to take a look at what's going on. Now, on the other hand.
And you address that through
through
updates.
Rules updates.
Right.
But on the other hand, if someone is saying, like, look, once per day, if I use this combination of daily powers, this combination of magic items, and these three feats, once per day I can do some math, it's like, well, you know what? That's okay, right? And that's something they're going to do once per encounter. I mean, it's kind of funny to think, here's a 30th level character who can kill Orcus in one shot. But at that point, you kind of wonder, well, does this really necessarily reflect what's in play? And what do we need to update to make that work?
My Hero Slayer Hydra would say that, yes, it's actually effects in play.
Yeah. Well, and that's good. Then you're looking at, okay, is this something that's coming up a lot? Is it going to distort the game? Is this a character someone's going to play? Or is this a theoretical character where it's like, you know, you couldn't actually... no one really play this character for 30 levels. It's only like if you took all this weird combination of stuff and multiclassing, and then you're gimped right. until level 30. But, you know, and in some cases, too, when you look at the level 30 abilities, especially for not Paragon Paths, for Epic Destinies, it's sort of like, well, that's kind of the point, though. You're level 30. You're allowed to do that. What we try to do, though, like, and that'd be a great example. Someone took a level 30 character and said, I could one-shot a level 30 elite. I'm like, eh, okay, that's pretty powerful. That's once per day. We won't really respond to this strongly if they said, I can one-shot any of the, like, a level 35 solos, like the gods and demons we've made. Mm-hmm. Then we'd look at it and go, okay, that's not something we really would want out there in the game, because that kind of undermines the point of playing. You're 30th level, you're taking on a god as the end of the campaign. It's lame if you can just kill that guy in one shot. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so the Hero Slayer Hydra, you know, if you have a party, this is the big elite, it's the really scary monster, and the power level of that character has gotten to the point where, okay, what should be a scary, daunting encounter is now trivial. Then we look at saying, okay, what do we need to update? The key, though, I think, is when you look at updates, it's not have a knee-jerk reaction. It's very easy to look at a mechanical situation and just say, okay, well, here's what's obviously broken, let's fix that. The important thing for us is to take a step back and say, what's the bigger picture issue? Is there a type of feat we've designed that's causing problems? Is there a bigger picture issue where it's not just this feat, it's design philosophy or design concept that's just not working within the game? Mm-hmm. And then go from there. Mm-hmm. So that's really the important thing, is not to just go banning individual powers or modifying individual feats, but to get the bigger picture view mm-hmm. of how the game works and how people are treating it. Mm-hmm. You know, there are definitely things where, as we've moved along in the game and looked at feedback, where we know, like, okay, here's this type of mechanic, we're not going to use that kind of mechanic anymore because we know it leads to trouble. So,
do you have any specific examples of those?
We look at critical hits. It was very easy for people. Like, so critical hits started out as, from design-wise, you know, hey, if a crit only happens 1 in 20, it's random, players can't control it, let's throw a lot of effects there. But then if you have things like, hey, you crit more often, well, now you're undermining that idea. And it's an example of two design ideals.
Your next attack is a free crit.
Exactly, where those come into collision. And it's really tricky, too, in D&D, because with the compendium and everything, all it takes is one feat that kind of goes rogue, and it messes up a lot of characters. Because now, you know, it's not like a collectible game or a miniatures game with where you have 1,000 points to build your army. You know, where, well, this is broken in a 5,000-point army, but you can't even get in a 1,000-point army. Mm-hmm. Or a magic deck, where it's like, okay, this card's really good, but you need this combination of cards to make it work, and someone can always counterspell it or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, D&D, your abilities are always all on all the time. So it puts a little more pressure on making sure that those combinations don't get out of whack. So.
This is probably a question better for you, but I'm going to address it and, you know, maybe it helps you out. Skill challenges have been another area that, you know, people have been talking about for a long, long time. There are entire blogs that, you know, spend a fair bit of time talking about it. How have you seen skill challenges progress in how they're used at the table, you know, people's impressions of them, and how is that evolving? You know, how has it evolved over the last couple of years? How do you see it evolving in the future?
Yeah, that's one of those mechanics where it started out in you know, it's completely new to D&D, so it's been really interesting watching how that's changed, how people are approaching it. And obviously, you know, there's the DCs, how do those work, and are people happy with those numbers? And I think for me, the biggest thing with skill challenges is when skill challenges first hit the scene, I think there are a lot of DMs. There's a lot of things where it seems like, oh, it's obvious that this would make a good skill challenge. Like the overland travel. If you're going from Hamlet to the city of Greyhawk, well, make that a skill challenge. That should be pretty interesting. What you find is when you start actually at the table, you're doing it, it's like, okay, make a survival check. Okay, we made it. Or, you know, make a perception check. I think what people are learning is they're taking the skill challenge and trying to find ways to make them a little bit more like combat, in the sense of there's a sense of rising tension. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of, you know, path A or path B, instead of win or lose. You know, like I remember an early skill challenge I played where we had to like excavate the entrance to a dungeon. And it's just, well, if we fail a skill challenge, does that mean we don't excavate the entrance and can't go into the dungeon? Like, what does that mean? You know, and it was, you can see the DM on the fly. Yeah, trying to change it and going, okay, this is how it should work. Or, you know, the way I think of it is skill challenges, I think it's best, and I think people are doing this more and more, to think first of the story and what's going on, and then build the mechanics around that skeleton to kind of support that. Mm-hmm. You know, to have a sense of rising tension. As each failure, you see more and more of the repercussions. you know, instead of just keeping those skill checks in isolation of, you know, you're fleeing Clintown Guard, what do you do? Well, I'm going to run away. Okay, make an athletics check. I succeed. Okay, well, you start running away, but you're still not yet away from me. Now what do you do? It's like, you need more drama there. You need more story. You need more things. Like, okay, well, you bolt off down, you know, away from them. You're gaining ground on them. And as you come around the corner, there's a merchant pulling a cart of turnips. Make an acrobatics check to get around it, or you crash into it. You know, things like
to
that.
To make it really specific.
Complications and
exactly. In a way, it's getting back to how people, I think, did that sort of encounter before skill challenges, where it's very narrative. The DM may be doing some improvising. And that's the hardest thing as a game designer, is what I want to just say to people is, hey, don't be afraid to improvise. You know? Like, I ran a skill challenge, when was it? It was one with, I think I wrote about it in skill challenge articles I've been written. I used to write, it kind of came to an end because I wasn't sure what else there was to say about it. But, you know, the characters are talking to this wizard, they're trying to get this item from him. He ends up tricking them, they fail the skill challenge, and he tricked them into taking an item that was a fake. And part of that just came when I was writing up the NPC. I thought, well, if I don't fight him, what's he going to try to do? He's going to try to trick them. Okay, and that kind of drove the skill challenge, just the role-playing of this character, where some of my earlier skill challenges, one of the first skill challenges I ran, was the characters were sneaking up on this tower, and it was just, okay, can you get up to the tower before the bandits notice you? And that one was more just static of, well, I'm just making checks, when they blow enough checks, the guards raise the alarm. You know, where the second one later on was more interactive, was more thinking, okay, here's my general guidelines, here's the skills and the DCs, but a lot of this is going to be role-playing. I'm just going to be depicting this Falrinth, this evil wizard, and all the cues are just going to come from his reactions and how I'm betraying him and sort of my character acting, my funny voices and stuff. Yeah. It's not just going to be this very mechanical tick-off stuff. I'm still doing that, but what the players are seeing is Falvin's role-playing and how he's reacting and what he's telling them. Yeah.
So you've written lots and lots and lots about skill challenges and all the published products and also online. If you had kind of one main tip you think you'd like to see more DM, do you watch a lot of DMs run skill challenges? Have you seen it kind of in the field?
Once in a while, like, especially here at like Gen Con with the RPG tables, I'll try to take a peek and see what people are doing with them.
Yeah, what one main piece of advice do you have for people that are running skill challenges? What do you kind of, is there a common problem that you'd say,
yeah,
I just wish they would know this?
Exactly. I think that thing would be, don't be afraid to improvise. That just like a combat encounter, skill challenge is like taking a combat encounter, and there's this tendency sometimes to script it all out in terms of here's everything that has to happen. But I think if you think of it more like a combat, we're like, you know what, I didn't think the archer would run into right a flank for that the thief, but he will because it makes sense, and now the thief's going to get sneak attack against the paladin or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, keep that sense of to improvise, of to challenge the characters, and to really narrate and make things compelling and interesting. I think the best skill challenge is the one where the DM's narration and description provides the answer of did you succeed the check or did you fail the check and how close are we to success or failure, where you can just tell by what's going on in the scene what's going on in the skill
it
challenge.
Gives you the proper feedback so
exactly.
Then you can sort of flow to the next thing.
Exactly.
The next. Now, do you think there would ever be, like in DMG 2, you covered, you had some really great example skill challenge. Do you ever think there might be room for like a small product like that, just sort of like a collection of skill challenges?
I think the, especially something like Dragon Magazine, you know, we're looking at, mm-hmm. just getting more examples out there. It's hard though with the examples, because like I said before, the improvisation, I think sometimes when people look at published skill challenges especially, they get the sense of, oh, okay, here's the script I'm going to follow. You know, and it's a little hard to break out of that going, this is a framework for the encounter. You know, like using the combat analogy, like in combat, you wouldn't just tell the PCs how many hit points a monster has left. Okay, you know, here's the orc guard. I hit him for 5. Well, he has 8 hit points left, so he's still standing. What do you do? Like, and I think the skill challenges, you want to break away from that. And I think that's the challenge facing us is when we do publish skill challenges, is how to present them in a way that embraces that improvisational or very narrative style of play rather than a very mechanistic style of play. So for combat, that just has happened naturally. People don't dwell on the mechanics so much. DMs just intuitively know to just describe things because they think to themselves, the players don't know how many hit points this thing has left. The skill challenge, the players have read the system, they know it's 3 failures. They know how many successes they need. So it's a little too easy to just fly into the, I rolled a 2, so I know that, hey, that's 1 failure, guys. Don't screw up, you know, don't fail twice more. You know, as opposed to the orc where you hit the orc, well, how many points is that left? I don't know. Is it bloodied? And then you're not really sure. What tricks can it do? You're not really sure what powers it may have, what tactics it might use.
Has there been any consideration of, like, opening that up, the sort of the X before 3 on it? In terms of, like, that structure?
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, so, yeah. Yeah, it's some of the things we've been talking about. Like, I know when Jonathan Tweet, when we were working on 4th, and I've seen this online for a couple places, you know, a skill challenge where the players just have X number of skill checks. Like, you have 10 checks, because you only have, like, an hour before something happens. What do you do, and do you, how many of those checks do you succeed in, you know? Things like that, where the players don't know the cutoff or point for failure or success. You know, that introduces a little more mystery and stuff. And that's something we might explore. I know, I think I've read, like, online people talking about doing it that way. And I think that's kind of, like, the next step, I think. Because I think when the article series ended, it was kind of like, okay, in this, I think you're right. Like, with this structure, I think I've said what I can say. Now what's the next step? I think it's a good point to look at. Let's maybe, just like in a combat, you can have an ambush, you can have, you know, the fight where you're also role-playing, the fight with the train's really important. Bringing that out in skill challenges and having those different structures.
Is there a, so that's a pretty, that's really good advice for a DM on running them. Is there a piece of advice that a DM can give to the players so that they enjoy a skill challenge more?
I think the big thing for me when talking to players is to get them to set aside the rules from the sense of how you're approaching it. It really is about getting into character and thinking like your character. And really finding ways to contribute. I see sometimes players just go, oh, I can't contribute, so I'm just going to sit out.
Because they look and they say, I'm not trained in any of those skills.
Exactly.
So I'll go get a drink.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's finding ways, like, you know, maybe you're not going to make skill checks, but you can still participate, right? You can still say, like, if you're in a social encounter, you can still say things. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're not making a diplomacy check, but you're still having a dialogue with NPC. You're still taking part. And be creative. Like, come up with plans. You know, like, maybe you're not trained in athletics, but maybe you come up with a way to, like, well, let's improvise a pole vault so I can get over the wall, you know, so maybe I get a bonus or something like that. Even if you're not making the check, maybe that's still something that another player could try doing. Mm-hmm. And it's always tricky in D&D when you give player advice, because really player advice only works as well as the DM lets it. You know, because in those situations you have to have a DM who's open to improvisation and everything like that.
So it has to be a perfect synergy between the players and their decisions and the DM and how they're handling it.
They have to be on the same page with that stuff.
Right. Do you have anything else?
Yeah.
We're hitting up at the top of our time.
Okay.
So we appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having us, guys. Appreciate it.
Very interesting, very helpful. We're looking forward to seeing where things go.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mike and Quinn. Now we'll throw it to me. I'm talking to Rodney Thompson and Rich Baker. Actually, I was talking to them simultaneously while Quinn and Mike were talking to Mike Merles at a table next door. But anyway, Rodney and Rich and I chat about Essentials, Dark Sun, and much more.
Okay, this is Jeff Greiner for The Tome Show, and we are talking to Rodney Thompson and Rich Baker here at Gen Con 2010, and they're going to spill all the secrets about what's going on with D&D these days.
That's right.
Let's start off with Rodney. You worked a little bit on the Essentials line, and there's been a lot of sort of buzz around Essentials lately. There's been a lot of, you know, leaks of things coming out and discussions going on.
Right.
What's been your experience working on the Essentials products?
Well, it's been great, obviously. And in fact, just earlier this week, on the way to Gen Con, we were playing D&D with Essentials characters on the train from Seattle to Chicago. So
you were part of the game train.
Yes, I was on the game train. I was running the games on the game train, so I got to play with, we had some Essentials characters, we had some, we had an Ardent from PH3, we had Dark Sun stuff, so a little bit of everything, and the Essentials stuff is a hoot to work on, and also seems to work fantastically, so.
Good. And how does the Essentials line sort of represent a change or a shift in design philosophy for Wizards?
I would say you're really looking at just an evolution, similar to how Player's Handbook 3 was an evolution of, you know, everything we learned up to this point. Essentials represents just further knowledge, further evolution like that. So I wouldn't necessarily call it a change, just as, you know, as the game goes along, we're going to learn how to do new things. I mean, if you look back at previous editions, that frequently happens, right? Like, third edition went on, philosophies changed, they picked up different styles, picked up different game design techniques. So, you know, it's sort of that same evolution. The more we play our own game, the more we learn about it.
There's certainly a bit of a complexity load in fourth edition that is appropriate for most folks who are experienced veteran gamers, and maybe a little bit tougher for people who want to play, frankly, a simpler character or concentrate on different parts of what they're doing as opposed to managing, like, daily and encounter resources. So, for example, you've seen the Essentials Fighter, I know we previewed. it's a fighter that plays a lot like an earlier edition fighter, but still we think is a very engaging and fun and fulfilling experience. It holds its own next to the fourth edition Player's Handbook fighter pretty well, but it does give you a different way to tackle a fighter, and we think that's some really interesting design space. We've had fun exploring it.
Right, that's actually a really good point. When you look at the dial of complexity, most of fourth edition sort of falls in a narrow band, and Essentials takes it and turns it down a little bit for the fighter and the rogue, but then up a little bit for, say, the wizard. The Essentials wizard is a little bit more tinkery, so that if you're playing the wizard more like in previous editions, you have a lot more options on a day-by-day basis. Your spellbook's a little more classical, like more like what you would think of as the 3.5 or previous edition spellbook. So it sort of goes both ways. There's some that turned up, some that turned down.
Yeah.
But trying to provide a variety of options for people that like to play in different styles. That's sort of one of the great things about D&D, is that it lets people that like lots of different things come together. And so Essentials really tries to do that mechanically. Like, if I like the simpler fighter and you like the more complex wizard, and someone else likes the sort of middle-of-the-road, say, barbarian or whatever, we can all sit at the same game table and play the same game and have fun and each have a similar experience, but, you know, tailored to our preferences.
Sure.
So that was sort of the big philosophy behind characters in Essentials, is making it something that more different types of players who have different types of preferences could sit at the same table and play the same game.
So it's about creating options.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things about Essentials that we've said a lot, is that these are more options for your game. So if you're going to play, you know, a Player's Handbook fighter and an Essentials fighter at the same table, you know, those are just different options. That's perfectly doable, right? And like I was saying, we had a PH3 Ardent who had some stuff from Sonic Power. We had the new Thief Rogue, and we had a knight fighter in the same game. Seamless, right? Works absolutely perfectly together, but provided very different levels of complexity for those players.
Let me hold on to a second. Okay, so we talk about Essentials being an evolution of the game in the same way, Rich, you worked on Gamer World, which uses similar system but evolves it and designs a little bit differently, as I understand.
Yes.
Is there a concern that with this evolution and as more options come out, that you run into some power creep? You know, do you hang out on the optimization boards at Wizards and freak out about the kinds of tricks people are pulling?
Well, in the context of Gamma World, no, we're not really as worried about power. There is power creep in Gamma World. Characters in Gamma World do a ton of damage,
right,
because they have fusion rifles, right, and things like that. Obviously, the more options you introduce, you know, the more combinations become possible, the better the characters that are possible for folks who want to go to the work of digging out and examining all those different combinations.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that in the fourth edition system, the power creep is definitely a much shallower advance than it was, let's say, in third edition. Right, in third edition, you could really build some pretty obnoxious characters because you could take any class at any time with a level advancement system in 3E. That was great for some things. For example, telling the wandering, meandering story of your character as he tries his hands at different things over the course of his career. But one of the downsides was it did mean that there are some very good synergies you could find if you went and looked for them. Fourth edition is walled off a little bit better from that sort of thing. But yeah, there's definitely, you know, you'll find better combinations of feats when there's 1,000 feats to pick from than when there's 20. And I guess more to the point, the fact that there's an enormous audience of players who are examining this, someone's going to notice an interaction that we missed, or just the power of the crowdsourcing, right, to figure out things that, you know, things that we just, help me out here, Roddy.
So the thing is, right, you know, we have extremely knowledgeable and capable fans, right? That's actually one of the big advantages of D&D, is that our fans, in a lot of ways, are the people that play our game, are game designers, because, you know, they're designing their own games, their own adventures, etc. So, you know, the power of, you know, tens of thousands of minds out there focusing on things, they're gonna, you know, they're gonna find things that we miss.
Yeah. Now they outnumber us, if nothing else.
Right. They would win in a fight. Let's put it that way. No. But actually, one of the big advantages of the way the fourth edition was designed was that we sort of know what we want the end point of our mechanics to be. Right. We know how much damage we're expected to put out at a given level as a player. Right. We know how many hit points monsters have. The way that fourth edition was designed was we looked at the end point and then we figure out how to get to that end point. And that's actually the thing that's made both Gamma World and Essentials possible in a lot of ways, because since we know what the end point is supposed to be, we can find lots of different routes to that end point, right? So the Essentials classes, they use different power progressions. They're simpler or more complex, but since we know where they need to get to, all we have to care about is, do they hit that point? Do they exceed it? Do they get, you know, close to it? And then things like, we want to make sure that every round people have interesting tactical choices and things like that as well. So having the endpoint in mind makes it so that we can, you know, keep power creep limited, although, you know, there will always be issues. Keep it limited, make sure we're getting to the right point, and not worry about, you know, this new mechanic we introduced, what does it do? We know exactly what it does. It gets you to, you know, gets you to this point. And so Gamma World, for example, Gamma World, and you could talk about this a little bit more, Rich, Gamma World has a very different player system that is not as, it's, you don't build characters like you do in D&D, and yet you get to a certain endpoint that, you know, we know provides a certain kind of gameplay experience. So Rich was talking about more damage. The reason we do more damage is because we want to have a faster game.
Sure.
Right.
So let's speak to Gamer World a little bit. Obviously, it is different, and it's evolved in a different direction, right? Which is appropriate word to use for Gamer World.
Devolved.
Yeah, yes. Whatever.
Mutated.
Yes. How much is Gamma World a mutated version of D&D? How much, you know, as a D&D player, am I going to sit down and instantly be familiar with Gamma World with just a few tweaks, or is it a significant change from the original?
Actually, this time around, Gamma World is a lot closer to the current edition of D&D than it ever has been in any of its previous editions. So, for example, we're talking about the same types of stats. Right, we don't have a mental strength score instead of wisdom. Right, that was kind of silly. Why was there a difference there? It just was a point of, yeah. I mean, other than the fact that wisdom maybe looks like, didn't feel post-apocalyptic enough. I don't know. Right, but there was a point of differentiation there where you didn't really understand. Okay, I don't know how the game, you know, what my defenses are. I don't know what my attacks are. Yeah, I had to kind of learn two different sets of terminology. This time we just said, you know, in Gamma World, characters have fort defense and reflex defense and armor class and hit points. Monsters are built on the same chassis as they are in D&D, so there's a much greater portability between Gamma World and 4th edition D&D than there ever was between any previous edition of Gamma World and the version of D&D that was out at that time.
So now I can use the fusion rifle to kill Elminster.
Absolutely. And you won't, it won't take you...
And I have. No. Not really.
And it won't take you but a moment.
Please don't kill Elminster to do that.
It's okay. He already killed him.
Oh,
haven't
right.
you read the new
that's,
novel?
That's right. That's right.
The only thing that where I think there's any bit of learning burden at all for a new Gamma World player who's familiar with D&D is probably in how the card works, the booster card system, and that's a snap, right? It's not hard because you come in knowing how to play D&D already. You figure out the cards, and essentially they're very close to being like extra encounter powers, right? They're a little bit more complicated than that, but generally you get to use, you know, one about once an encounter for your deck and for your mutation, and you're set, right? And I think it's actually going to be very useful to people who are like game mastering Gamma World, that they now have the entire library of D&D monsters to plunder.
Sure.
Right, you're not just limited to the specific Gamma World monsters we can create and put into a Gamma World product. You can go grab anything out of the Monster Manual 3 or 2 or 1 that struck you as, boy, that's a kind of strange mutated sort of a thing. Whoever thought of a, you know, Mind Flayer? Mind Flayers should be space aliens. Everyone knows that. Well, okay, if you felt that way, you can drop Mind Flayers right in your Gamma World game, and you know what? They'll work just fine.
Yeah, one of the specific goals of design development was to make sure that on the DM side of the screen, it was easy to port things back and forth.
Okay, so
both worked on Dark Sun.
Yes.
Yes.
And Dark Sun is just coming out, depending on where you're at and what stores you visit and what have you. So how does Dark Sun change the design concepts of 4th edition? You know, previous editions, Dark Sun was the same system, right, but a very different sort of campaign setting. How does Dark Sun this time around design work with 4th edition?
Well, in terms of mechanics, Dark Sun is pretty close to the 4th edition wheelhouse, right? I mean, there are a couple of important new elements, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you don't really have to learn much in the way of new mechanics to play Dark Sun. The big difference in Dark Sun essentially is story and feel, right? And what sorts of adventures do I go on? What sort of person am I in this world? And that's a place where I think you had the biggest divergence in experience. Is, you know, you're not an elf running around the forest doing. Raiding enemy castles or plundering, classic dungeons. You're an elf who's a thief and a peddler and a raider running across the sands to attack a caravan because you want to plunder it and get rich, you know.
Or survive.
Or just survive, yeah. Right, yeah. You have a different set of motivations. It's a harder, crueler world. That's always been the premise of Dark Sun, the promise of it, I guess. In terms of the mechanical aspects, the biggest, most notable change is that we're introducing the idea of character themes in Dark Sun. A character theme, it's a little bit like the kits from second edition. It's sort of like a third part of your character identity that comes after race and class, right? You're an elf ranger, but are you a wasteland nomad? Are you a dune trader? Are you a secret member of the Veiled Alliance? Are you an elf ranger who's actually a gladiator? Right, these are all options that you can kind of bolt onto that basic concept of elf ranger that tells a very different story about the kind of character you're playing each time you change that knob. They have certain mechanical bonuses and features, obviously, each one. Every theme comes with a theme power so that you get a sense of, you get to kind of be your theme every time you play. But by and large, I think kind of the most important part of the theme is the fact that it really anchors you in the world and says, this is the story you're telling about your hero.
So how does, in terms of, back to this idea of power, right? Dark Sun traditionally in the past has been a much, characters have to be much more powerful,
right,
to survive. Does the theme add a significant amount of power so you still get some of that idea, or is it more like a racial power sort of power level?
It's more like a racial power level. In terms of characters being tougher to survive, keep in mind, I think a lot of what Dark Sun introduced has actually become formalized now by the time you're in 4th edition. For example, most 4th edition characters are walking out the door at first level with 20 to 30 hit points, right? So that's a place where we said, you know, characters need to be more durable at first level. All characters do in all worlds. We want people to feel more heroic as first level guys. So that's a place where I don't think Dark Sun necessarily came down to match everything else. Everything else kind of came up to match Dark Sun and start you off tougher. Ability scores, getting big ability score bonus. Everyone remembers that Dark Sun was a world where you could have a strength of 20. Well, the bonuses that are associated with the different ability scores, back in second edition you needed to have 16s and 17s and 18s to get. In third edition, those ranges were normalized a lot more. Fourth edition kept those. So now you don't have to have ability scores of 19s and 18s and 17s to have very competent characters. The standard ability score array that every character gets access to in fourth edition kind of lets you, you know, stack bonuses on almost everything you're doing, all your defenses and such.
Which, of course, allows more portability, right?
Yeah.
I can take the Dark Sun monsters and put them in my Forgotten Realms game or whatever.
Exactly. That was something we were pretty intent on keeping.
And the one thing we did do to sort of capture the Dark Sun feel is we sort of assumed that the alternate inherent enhancement bonus rules from DMG2, we sort of assumed that that's what's the standard for your campaign. So that, you know, the the players don't necessarily need to have magic weapons or magic armor to have their sort of core competency. And that, you know, that really fits the Dark Sun motif, right? Like the guys running around with the bone sword, right? Doesn't necessarily have to be a magic bone sword to be as effective. And I think that really fits the motif. And that's really what we're talking about in Dark Sun, is mechanical tweaks that alter the feel subtly without becoming a giant, you know, transition, right?
And that change, in assuming that everybody's getting the inherent bonuses, that makes things like the new breakage rules
right
possible.
Exactly.
Nobody's going to choose to break a magic sword.
Yeah, we definitely explore a lot of new and alternate rules in Dark Sun. Things like weapon breakage, armor overheating. We got wild talents, which are little sonic cantrips. These are all things that are not that much different than things we already have in 4th edition, so they're not big leaps. Many of them are optional. The way that defiling works in the new Dark Sun is sort of an add-on. Instead of changing the rules, we sort of created a toolbox that the DMs and the players can use to pick and choose the specific elements that they want to make it their vision of Dark Sun. Because they're, you know, while Dark Sun has a very strong feel, there are also sort of differing camps of, oh, I don't like weapon breakage, but I do like defiling. Well, I'm not big on defiling, but I really like, you know, armor overheating. And so we sort of put the power in the hands of the players and DMs to decide what, you know, these are the things we think make 4th edition, you know, appropriate for Dark Sun, and we let players and DMs choose how much or how little of that to bring into their games.
So how much of the new mechanical options that we see in Dark Sun could or possibly will see supported integration into other settings? You know, are we going to, is it possible we'll see a DDI article bringing templates or wild talents into Forgotten Realms or Eberron?
We're pretty happy with the theme notion, the way we like them. We think there's a lot of application for them outside of Dark Sun. So I think down the road you'll probably see them appearing in core D&D. It's just a matter of when's the right place to.
In the same way that backgrounds jump from backgrounds into core.
Exactly. Gosh, any others that you can think of?
I think that, like, I'm not positive, but I think wild talents, you could see the transition there.
There's a lot of them as a DM, I imagine. You could choose.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. In fact, that's one of the kind of nice
things.
It's
eminently lootable.
Yeah, that's the nice things about the optional rules is we sort of designed them to work well with our core rules, but also be a thing that could be pulled out or put in at will. So I think you can do that with the, you know, if you decide that your Forgotten Realms game really needs weapon breakage rules, I think you could drop that in, and as long as you're, you know, aware of the effects and aware of the idea that, you know, it's designed to work with the inherent enhancement bonus rules, that should be very portable.
Good. Anything else that you guys have coming up in the near future that you can talk about that we should be keeping an eye out for?
What are you ready to spoil for us?
Gosh.
I know that.
The Red Box is the big thing coming up in September, of course. If you haven't had a chance, I know it doesn't help your listeners very much, but we do have a copy down in the booth here, all kind of broken out, so you can see all the components. You know, it might be worth a look, so you can just kind of see what's coming up.
I think they're playing some games here.
There are some demos of the Red Box here at the show. Red Box is sort of our, you know, our back to the classics introductory set. It's also based heavily on the work we did on Essentials. In fact, you would call it a part of the Essentials line. It's one of those product set. So, you know, the Essential Fighter and the Red Box Fighter are the same thing. They're cut from the same cloth. It really is designed to give you a more classic experience like that.
And it's definitely, like I said, it is a starter product. It gets you through first and second level. One of the interesting things is you have, basically, as you, I wouldn't call it really a pick-up path, but as you play through your first game, you develop your first character. So it introduces systems kind of slowly. If folks are looking for a great product for bringing other people into the game, I think that's it's something they might want to take a look
at. That's where the Red Box sits.
Yeah.
So, in terms of that Red Box, then, is it something that as somebody who's been playing D&D since I was 8, am I going to have an interest in Red Box, or should I maybe just pick up the Essentials for the new options and point new players to the Red Box?
I think it could go either way. I mean, certainly there's a lot of nostalgia value for the red box, right? I mean, if you play with the original, you might want to pick up this one. It's a nice set.
There are some nice components like maps and tokens and things like that. You would definitely get some value out of
it. Sure. Yeah, it's got some good tokens. It does have an adventure in it, so it's got that as well. Yeah. It's also nice because even if you've been playing for a while, occasionally we have the new player that jumps into the campaign and you teach them how to play. The player book has got the choose your own adventure aspect that not only introduces here's how you get your stats, but also here are the kinds of things that you can expect out of a D&D game. So it might be handy just to have, you know, in your hip pocket for when your campaign picks up a new player, especially someone who's not familiar with D&D. Or, you know, if you have, you know, oh, I've got a 12-year-old cousin who wants to find out about D&D, I can loan them my red box or whatever like that. So.
And the red box should be easier to because you've also put out a product early in 4th edition that was sort of had the same concept, but you didn't redesign anything, right? The basic set.
Right. The red box is designed to, I don't say ease players in a little bit better, but give them a better introduction to the story of the game, the world behind the game, as a reading experience, right? If I'm a player that picks up, you know, a rule book, it might seem a little dry. If I'm a player that picks up a choose your own adventure, which is how you create your characters in Redbox, I'm reading a story, it's entertaining, and it's also, you know, giving me the rules I need.
So other than Redbox, Gamma World, anything else coming out that we should be looking for?
Castle Ravenloft, I think, is another big one.
Do you guys work on that?
I play tested it a bit. Okay. Peter Lee, Mike Merles, and Bill Slavicek were the designers behind it. But like anything, playtesting and development is a big part of the process as well. So I got to do a lot of playtesting. And then, of course, on the game train, we brought a copy with us to play. So I'm a fair hand at the game so far. But
I don't think we talked about this on the mic before. Talk about the game train then.
Oh, yeah, the game train. So, and we'll get back to Ravenloft in a second. But yeah. So the game train, basically, four of us took a train from Seattle to Chicago. And since you're on the train and you're not having to worry about driving, it was kind of like a road trip where everybody got to hang out and have fun. So we took Castle Ravenloft, the board game, and we took a Dark Sun adventure that I designed. And I ran that adventure for the other three guys that were with me. And basically, we spent around 56 hours on a train, thanks to a delay, pretty much doing nothing but playing board games, playing D&D, and eating and sleeping. So it was essentially a nice two-day chunk of time where we didn't have to care about anything else except for gaming on our way to Gen Con. So it was a blast.
So next year, that'll be a great pre-Gen Con event.
Yeah,
people can fly out to Seattle and then ride with you guys on the train and play games.
I ask our legal department if that's for sure, but no, I'm definitely doing it again. It was an absolute blast. But yeah, so we got to play a lot of Castle Ravenloft too, which was nice. Castle Ravenloft is designed to be a cooperative board game experience. It takes about an hour to play. Some scenarios may take a little longer or less. But basically, it's a cooperative D&D board game, very heavily influenced by 4th edition, but also designed to be something that, you know, four of us could sit around and play without a DM and have, you know, have a good time. It's influenced.
Plays faster, obviously, right? You don't need to sit down all Thursday evening to play your game, right? You can play some of the shorter Castle Ravenloft scenarios really in about 30-40 minutes. The longer ones might take you, the bigger ones might take a little bit longer than that, but you know, really once you have it, it goes real quick. And
it'd be a good thing maybe to keep on hand, you know. A couple of your players show up early and you need something to kill half an
hour. It's great for warm-up.
You know, I'm the DM and I ran out of story and we got an hour left to play. Let's play some Ravenloft.
Yeah, it's great for warm-up. It's great for those sessions where, Bill canceled the last minute. We don't have enough players to play. Well, we can pull this out and play and have a good time. It's also, you know, just a nice thing to have on hand for those nights where you got an hour to kill and nothing else to do, but you want kind of a D&D experience.
Sure.
The game's actually based, influenced heavily by the cooperative board games that are out there now. So anyone that's familiar with games like Pandemic or Shadows Over Camelot, games like that, or even games like Descent or, you know, D&D 4th Edition, it's got a very familiar feel, but it also, you know, has some really nice components, and it's one of those things that you can pull out on short notice and have a satisfying D&D experience.
Real quick, Rich, any new books in the works?
The next one coming up for me is the paperback version of Avenger, the third book in the Blades of the Moonsea series. I believe that will be out later this fall, like around November or December. And they're starting to bug me about, hey, wouldn't it be nice to do another Forgotten Realms novel? So possibly next one will be an FR book, maybe in late 2011, early 2012.
So you haven't started working on anything yet then? Or?
No, I'm still enjoying my break after finishing the trilogy.
Good.
But now it looks like it's time to get back to work.
All right, good. All right, gentlemen, thank you for your time, and hope to talk to you again sometime.
Yeah, thanks. It was great.
And now it's time to go to the crew of Fistful of Comics and Games, who are also talking to Rodney Thompson along with Mike Merles. But this time, they're asking questions after the product announcement that were made Saturday morning. So we get to ask some follow-up questions and find out a little bit more about things that we didn't know about during the first set of interviews.
Hi, this is Ben from The Tome. And this is Chris from Fistful of Comics and Games. We're here with Mike Merles from WotC.
Hey.
Lead designer of D&D or not?
Right now, my title is group manager.
Group manager.
Of D&D, yeah. So more manager now than just design. So.
Okay, excellent.
Cool.
So, not to be cliche, but how's your con been?
It's been good. It's been fun. I mean, Gen Con's always pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of getting the word out about Essentials and Castle Ravenloft. Ravenloft's kind of cool. It's my first board game ever designed. Awesome. At least designed and printed. So it's been kind of exciting seeing the reaction to it. And it's funny because I worked on about 90% of it. At the very end, when they're finishing it up, I had to start work on the D&D Essentials stuff. This was like last year. Mm-hmm. So there's like just enough rules where I don't know them. So I'm definitely getting like, oh, I designed this game and I know most of it. It's like, I was just, you know, too busy, you know, drinking or whatever the last week. I don't really remember all the details. So, but it's I'm really excited. I'm really happy how it came out. So,
So I haven't actually looked at it myself. How close is it to D&D, maybe not D&D rules, but it looks like dungeon tiles kind of, and some repurposed minis from the D&D mini line, but...
Yeah, so basically there's like a sort of twofold strategy with this game. Like I'll show you here, there's a fighter, if you look at the fighter stats, he has an armor class, he has hit points, he has speeds and squares just like in D&D. Yep. He has a surge value, so when you spend a healing surge, it's how many hit points you get back. So there's kind of like a two-prong approach to this game, where if you played D&D before, you know almost all the basics, except for how there's a few issues with as far as the deck. There's a treasure card deck, encounter deck, monsters. But you know the basics just to get going. On the other hand, if you don't know D&D, but you like games like Descent or other hobby board games, this essentially teaches you the basics of D&D. So maybe you can go from here to playing the full D&D role-playing game. There's no DM, so it's probably the thing you have is you've played D&D, you have to learn, spend the most time learning is how to run the game without a DM.
Mm-hmm.
And even really like the sort of D&D idea, I mean, really even carries through where the scenarios, we call them adventures.
Okay.
They have read aloud text. I'll grab an adventure at random. You know, you have this adventure here, it's called Daylight Assault. You know, the idea is you're trying to go into the dungeon and defeat the monsters while it's still daylight, because obviously like werewolves and stuff are come out at night. And there's some, you know, when you start the adventure, read some flavor text. There's a tracker for when the sun sets, so when the sun sets, read this.
It's sort of similar in that way vein to Betrayal in the House on the Hill.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. There's some elements there. Which, Betrayal, by no accident, that's a game I found a lot of role players tend to like that game. You know, a lot of crossover there. So really trying to build a story to the game. So it feels like a D&D experience. I mean, obviously you can't have a full story experience of the depth of a world in a cooperative board game like this, but really aiming at it. I mean, the kind of idea was I was inspired. I was at one of the inspirations for it, for at least for me. I was at a cookout at a friend's place.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone there played D&D, and we decided, hey, let's play games. And we wouldn't have thought, like, well, let's play D&D, right? Because, you know, we have to take time to pick up characters.
Yep.
Who's going to be the DM? And this gives you, hopefully, like a D&D experience you can just sort of pick up and play. Like, in that situation, hey, let's play Castle Ravenloft, you know? So that's kind of led a lot of the sort of basic overview of some of the elements of it.
This game looks really sweet. I've heard of there's another game, something of Ashardalon.
Yeah.
It's like a
dragon. Yeah, exactly. Wrath of Ashardalon is coming out in November. It's the same basic system. And one of the strengths we have, since this core system is relatively simple, a lot of the complexity, I don't want to say complexity, but a lot of the flavor and a lot of the exceptions rests inside the individual adventures. So in Wrath of Ashardalon, it's centered on a dragon. This is sort of centered on Strahd, a lot of undead. It's a little more traditional dungeon crawling. There's, you know, dragon is one of the main villains, like an Odiug miniature it comes with. that's more focused on a traditional dungeon crawl, and in the adventures we can do a very different experience by giving different flavor text, different special exceptions, you know, kind of like in, I'll give you some examples, like in the Ravenloft adventures, there's one adventure we talked about, the Daylight Assault, that has a time track. We used to track when the sun sets.
Mm.
There's another one here, there's one where you have to escort someone who's been bitten by a werewolf into the dungeon to find the fountain where they can be healed of lycanthropy. There's a chance they can turn into a werewolf while you're trying to get them to safety.
Oh, wow.
One of the first adventures is you recover the icon of Ravenloft. You know, there's different rules for when you find the icon, a bunch of monsters show up. You have to defeat them. You know, since so many of the rules are embedded in these adventures, when we do Wrath of Shardalon, we can just think, well, what are the typical dragon-based adventures that are existing in D&D? We can make an adventure that's built around that. And that has different tiles, different miniatures. So if you want to mix and match them, you can do that. We're planning on, through the website, rolling out new adventures, new rules options. And one of the kind of cool things, if you think there's the encounter deck, which essentially, here, I'll pull it. There's the monster deck, and there's the encounter deck. And one of the things that those do is essentially those act as the DM. When you draw an encounter card, it'll say, okay, this is what's happening now. There's a trap goes off, or an NPC shows up.
Okay.
So what you can do is just by tailoring the encounter deck, we could tell you, for example, like the cards have names. Like here's an event card. It's like Ghost of Prince Oral. When he shows up, it causes triggers an event. And this one, it causes you to discard some of your powers.
Oh, dear.
And so we could say, okay, to build the deck for this adventure, this scenario, we could just list the cards to put in the adventure deck. We could list them from like a Shardalon and from this game to combine them together so you could have a unique scenario,
Cool.
And same with the monsters. The monsters have, the monster card has its stats, armor class, and hit points. There's a pretty simple series of if-then statements attached to them. When the monster goes, you just look at the first statement. This one, it's a gargoyle. And the first step is, if the gargoyle is within one tile of a hero, then it tells you what to do.
Uh-huh.
And then usually in almost all these, there'll be one conditional. If you don't meet that, it just tells you otherwise, this is what it does. So that's really how the game sort of acts as a dungeon master, running the monsters for you.
Cool. It even has an experience value.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah. To go through, and that lets us see you can tailor how tough the monster is. A 3 XP monster is worth three times as much as a 1 XP monster. So zombies 1 XP, gargoyles 3.
Okay.
And that ties into the rules for leveling up. And there's also rules where you can cancel encounter cards by spending XP. That just kind of represents you have some experience fighting through the dungeons. You avoid the event before it goes off or the trap or something.
Neat. Very cool.
And I've heard there's a third board game in the works, but it's not quite like this.
Yep, there is an Axis and Allies-based D&D game coming out, and I am going to get the name wrong, because the name has changed several times. It's a Conquest of Narrath, or something like that. I think it was Conquest of Narrath. Yeah, it's an Axis and Allies-style game. Fantasy armies fighting, two factions, just like Axis and Allies, you play the Axis, play the Allies, players team up. It has a very similar feel to that of marshaling armies. And of course, it has a D&D angle. You have heroes you also command that you can send into dungeons to try to recover artifacts to help your army. Kind of similar, maybe like the tech upgrades and Axis and Allies, except you have to go adventuring for them. Mm-hmm. So
it's kind of like that one computer game. It was like a RTS, but you had adventures going and
Warlords, I think. It was Warlords. Yeah. Yeah, so it's really the way we kind of look at it is D&D is a lot more than just the RPG.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kind of want to broaden. D&D's it's been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. A lot of people like D&D for different reasons, the novels, the computer games, the tabletop game. So it's really just about like bringing, like, figuring out what's the distinct flavor of D&D and bringing that to different types of games.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Very cool.
Speaking of that, Gamma World, which at first I looked at that, I thought, oh, it's a board game like Ravenloft, but no, it's a D&D-based game,
Oh, exactly. So what we're trying to do with, so I can't go into too much detail on Gamma World. That's coming out in a couple months. But what's sort of the aim of it is we think of, if you know the basics of 4th edition, and you want to try exploring other genres, it's a little bit like the Call of Cthulhu D20 game that came out with 3rd edition, where we're taking the basic guts of 4th edition and expanding them on to a different genre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we also wanted to do with Gamma World, a lot like Castle Ravenloft, where it's pretty easy to just pick up and play, we wanted to make an RPG a little bit like a board game in the sense of it's boxed, comes with all the components you need, except for dice. You have to buy your own dice at Gamma World. But you can just pop it open, and within an hour, you're playing the game.
Cool.
To really cut down the time it takes to learn the game, to do that, we try to use a lot of 4E rules. You already understand that. Character creation's random. You're rolling on tables to find your mutations. The monsters are fully compatible with D&D, so if you've played ran D&D, you know how to run the monsters, handle that. It comes with a complete adventure. And the other thing we've added is a deck of cards to represent mutations and tech that you can find in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of adds a random element. We kind of want to make a game that's like light compared to D&D, a little more random, a little more fast play.
Okay, so.
So it's very much... this was very much Wizard's stated goal to create games that are... It's almost like introductory D&D games.
Yeah, exactly. In Game World's case, Game World's a little bit different because it's aimed at existing D&D players.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of like, you can think of it, if you already know D&D, this is like your introduction to Gamma World as a D&D player.
Yeah.
So, again, we kind of see it as a game that you might play in addition to D&D, or it's like a diversion. You know, we really want to emphasize what was different about it.
Seems like a good tutorial system.
Yeah.
Now we have a new guest introducing as well to the to the podcast. Rodney Thompson, one of the lead designers of the Dark Sun campaign setting, is here with us now on the Gen Con loft area.
The head of the tome has the list of questions here, and I'm trying to decipher his writing. But
we dare not offend him.
I was going to watch out for the boss.
Yeah.
Well, as a purely Dark Sun related question, I didn't get it off in the seminar. There, in a book I'm reading right now, there's like a psionic tiger type creature.
The tiger, I think, yes.
Yeah, are they going to be resurfacing? Or?
They're actually in the creature catalog, yeah. All right. We've,
awesome.
We actually, when we did the creature catalog, we went back to the old Monsters Compendiums from 2nd edition and looked through and saw, you know, which ones are good ones to translate forward, which ones have a really good book, and which ones really fit into the world. And most of the ones we picked out were things we thought really had a lot of both, you know, cash for the fans and also had a lot of potential for good stories. So really made it in there. You know, the character made it in there because it was one that a lot of people remembered too.
I guess I don't know if you can answer this or anything, but the Heroes of Shadow book that was announced, it's not Player's Handbook 4, but Player's Handbook. Is that like the face of things to come? There's not going to be like a numbered Player's Handbook anymore, or?
Yeah, one of the things we want to try to do with the Heroes of Shadow is with a Player's Handbook, that's kind of a format you see with that, like new races, new classes, and it's pretty much the sum total of it. With Shadow, we wanted to make a lot more options that any character could take. So while there are new builds for existing classes, and there are maybe some other surprises in there, and there's some new races, also I think the race chapter would be a great example. There are some new races in there, but also about half the chapter just talks about like elves, humans, dwarves, and what they think of Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
What are the cultural associations with Shadow? Like, if you looked at the assassin on DDI, there are a bunch of race feats that speak to assassins with, you know, like Obsidian Cave or dwarves. Well, we talk about the Obsidian Cave, that is a guild of assassins, or that is a cabal of shadow magic users. And here's their role in dwarf society. If you're a dwarf shadow user, you know, here is the place where you go. It is called the Obsidian Cave. You journey there. Which is the final stages of mastering your magic.
Cool.
Yeah, to really bring it to life, and it's pure story, but it's just to give it a place in the world of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the design going forward, and you know, and Rodney can talk a little bit about this because he's working on a shadow class that's going to be on DDI,
right,
we're doing
yes.
the Essential Assassin.
Awesome.
Where, I mean, how would you say when you worked on the Assassin, what did you start with?
To be honest with you, I kind of started with the first edition Assassin in a lot of ways, right? I think the thing to think about when you're designing stuff like a new class under the new model is to start with what's this person's role in the world, what's their story, and then start designing mechanics that fit that, and eventually that'll sort of form itself into, okay, this guy's starting to look like a striker, so let's make him a striker, or this guy's starting to look like a controller, let's make him a controller. So. It's not a radical shift in the philosophy, but it's definitely a change in the way we approach the starting point, right? I think that the assassin, for example, when we start talking about how an assassin behaves, when you think about an assassin in the context of literature, it's typically like there's the one stab with the dagger or the one cross revolt or something like that. So we started with some mechanics that made it a little bit easier to get off that kind of feel. I mean, mm-hmm. in 4th edition, right, you think
without
about...
Without 3 rounds of doing right, nothing but staring at your opponent.
So I'm the assassin, I jump out, I stab him, and then now he's bloodied. Okay, 4 rounds later, I finally took the guy down. And that's, you know, that's fine, but we really want the assassin to have that one big punch, right,
uh-huh,
that good assassination.
Uh-huh.
And so that's sort of one of the first things we figured out, and clearly that led us to, okay, this guy's clearly a striker, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, assassins are well known for, like, poison use, so we do a lot of stuff with poisons. In fact, that sort of sits in their daily area, is their poison. So I think it's just a good example of how we start with a story and then fill in the blanks of the mechanics based on that. And we're lucky that usually story archetypes fit very well into our mechanical archetypes as well, right? I mean, that's probably a result of just, you know, the way D&D has been designed for 30 plus years, right? We're trying to sort of stick to that and make sure that everything makes sense in the world context as well as mechanical.
Very cool.
And that kind of fits into the Shadowheart source book, where we started saying, what is shadow magic in D&D? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to people in the world of D&D? What are its kind of ground rules in D&D? And then working from there to fill out that book with different options and how they work and a unique flavor. So it's kind of taking a more holistic view of the design than, say, a more mechanical view.
I guess Jeff wanted me to ask about the rules compendium. How's it going to be organized? I was talking with him about a third edition one. He was like, yeah, I liked it, but the way it was organized, it was alphabetical and it was hard for him to use it. Is it going to be like that or thematic?
It's much more thematic. It's much more like a traditional rule book, like for a board game or something. Obviously, it's D&D, so it's going to be longer. But yeah, it's much more organized as a rule book and as a reference. The 3.5 one was a little bit more of a, I'd say, like almost a kind of behind the scenes look at how the game worked. Mm. It's almost more like a little encyclopedic in that you just think of a topic and go read about it, where this is more of an at the table reference.
Yeah, it's really designed to be something that you can sort of take to the table along with your character, and that's really all you need. And so if you're going to look for things on, like, I need to jump over a pit, I need to look up the athletics rules, you look in the skill section, not go all the way back to A or something like that. And then that way you also have the other sort of tangential rules about the skills around it as well, not just the ones for the athletic skill.
Very cool.
The red box, from all that I've heard about, there's some kind of, like, maybe a choose-your-own-adventure style thing to making your character, and I thought it was kind of interesting, but...
Yep, so we have a copy here, so I'm kind of speaking along as I show it off. So yeah, if you've never played D&D before, or you just crack open the red box and want to make up a character, it starts with a pretty basic choose-your-own-adventure scenario. There's a goblin, you're traveling with a caravan, there's a goblin ambush. So what do you do? And what it does is, as you go through and make choices, it starts to fill in your character sheet. You start with a blank character sheet. You can see here, based on some choice you made, you might end up with a sword. Like, let's say you decided, hey, you grab a sword, you want to start acting like a fighter. Well, then you probably want to play a fighter. So it just shows you elements of the character sheet and just shows you what numbers to put in, what notes to take. So it starts like your armor class, your hit points.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it's really nifty just in the end when, you know, here's a path where if you want to be a wizard, it starts telling you, okay, write down Phantasmal Force is one of your powers, your spell. Fill in your defenses. Yeah, and so the idea is by the time you get to the end, you built an entire character. You know, and it's your first level character. So built through play, which I think is just, it's a fun way to get someone straight into the action. And there's even a section here, like, here's one choice where, depending on what you choose, you can either end up being good, unaligned, lawful good. You know, kind of talk about role-playing and how that works in the game. And the kind of nice thing is when you go through this adventure, by the end of it, the story of this adventure ties into the group adventure that the DM runs. It's in the DM's book. So it's a clear story. Like, you start with this, and then we assume now you're going to play the group adventure. It ties together into one story.
Really clever.
The adventure is actually a really great example of the philosophy of starting with an interesting and compelling story and then leading the player to that story and then to the mechanics following after it, right? I mean, it's a choose-your-own-adventure book, so you're actually thinking like, okay, my character would think like this and he would act like this and he would make these decisions, and A, it's teaching you how to role play, but B, it's also teaching you the mechanics of the game at the same time. So it's sort of the best of both worlds in a lot of ways.
I think it's really interesting how you're making mechanical choices, but it's veiled, as you said, in very much a role-playing flavor choice. Right. It's like, well, my character would do this.
It's really because that's the way most role-players think about their characters. Like, when you think about what you're doing, you're thinking about it in the context of a larger world, right? And so this is just encouraging that behavior and then also using it as a method of teaching. I actually taught a new person how to play D&D on the way to the convention earlier this week, and the way I did it was by teaching her the story of her character first and then the mechanics second.
Awesome. Very cool.
So not to pick on any other RPG system, but is there a way to die in character creation because of this?
I don't You know what? There might be. Because there is a segment, it might be when you're mostly done with your character, but there's a segment where you kind of go in this freeform mode. It's like, there's a section where you fight a goblin.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, after you've had your character built, you then get like a sort of summarized goblin stat block right here. You go to the goblin there, and you have to take on a goblin. So it is possible, okay, perhaps, it's a minion, through a hard, hard, hard set of rolls, you could end up dying.
Yeah, that's actually, it is possible. And since it's a solo adventure, there's nobody there to heal you, right? So,
so potentially bad.
Yeah, yeah, and you can lose. There is a dun, 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 you lose, like there is an entry right here I just looked at, not to spoil it, but yeah, you can be defeated by the minion.
That would be a humiliating start to your role-playing career. Granted, I've been killed pretty badly by kobolds, so I shouldn't talk.
Yeah, this is the one big difference between this and those old Choose Your Own Adventure books is it always seemed like half of the endings were, and you die horribly, right? So.
This seems relatively far out there.
Right.
So, I guess Ravenloft is coming back kind of next year, maybe?
Yeah.
It's not exactly a campaign setting, but...
How does that work out? And are the Domains of Dread coming back because of it?
We can't really go into too many details yet.
Okay.
So we have the teaser, but as Bill said, it is... Someone asked him at the seminar today, is it a campaign setting or is it a game? And he said both, and that's correct. It is both. So we'll see as we get closer to the release date, we'll start talking more about it. But.
Alright. And I have a note here. There's a new magic item system with...
Yes.
Degrees of rarity. How does that mesh with the current like level-based system?
It's still based by level. You still have nothing's changed. Like, if you have a magic item right now, like Adventurer's Vault, nothing's actually changing. The mechanics are still the same. Unless it gets updated, Bureau of Rules update. But the idea is kind of talk what Ron was talking about before, about you know, looking at the fiction of D&D, like the world. We're breaking items down as common, uncommon, or rare.
Cool.
Now the big difference is in terms of the world. Common items are items that anyone with any half-decent amount of magical training knows how to make. They're the most common formulas and recipes. Uncommon ones are obviously less well-known, and as a default, the characters don't have access to that.
Okay.
And rare ones are even more powerful, and those are probably ones that were forged long ago or by some great power. It's very rare that such an item is actually made.
So practically an artifact.
Exactly. Not quite there, but getting closer in terms of power. The way we think of it in terms of the story is the common item is just the item you go by. It's plus, plain old-fashioned plus one sword. The uncommon magic sword might be a flaming plus one sword.
Okay.
You know, it can burst into flames. Maybe as an attack, we can use it to blast monsters with flame. The rare sword might be the Holy Avenger, where it's something you think of like a character who's in a story or in the game. It's one of the first things you might mention with a character if you to describe them. You know, this is the Paladin with the Holy Avenger. That's very noteworthy. So it has two effects. First of all, it kind of maybe meshes better with the world of D&D. Like, there's the idea of the magic item Walmart people talk about. It kind of removes that, because characters can only play as a default, can only purchase common items. Obviously, you can host with that very easily. And that's something I really like about the system. It's something I want to explore more of. A system like that is very easy to manipulate. Like, you could say, I want to run a very magic rare game, so the only magic items that are available are common items, and you can't buy them. That'll have a very different feel of a super high magic campaign where... all I'm giving out are rare items. Everyone has a bunch of rare items, and it's all item-driven. So it's very easy to house rule and to tweak to fit the familiar campaign. And on the other hand, since we know people simply just can't buy these items, it opens up a lot of design space for us. Because we can go ahead and make an item that's really powerful, really interesting, has a lot of stuff going on, and we know the DM will not add that to the campaign unless he wants to.
Cool. It really is a layer we're sort of laying over our existing magic item system to... give more signposts to the DM for how to distribute treasure.
And I guess, is a compendium going to be like, is there going to be like a little note on the items in the compendium?
I believe so,
like,
yeah.
Like retrofit them?
And as a default, existing items will be uncommon, and we're working through a list now of items that we'll label as common. So we may do something with the community to just say, hey, submit items you think should be common, and we'll just do things like that.
Very cool. Well, I guess it's time to wrap up, so thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was great talking to you guys.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot, guys.
And have a good drink.
You too.
Thanks.
All right. And there's the Gen Con interviews. Thanks for listening. This is the end of my audio from Gen Con. So from here on out, we're back to the normal routine and the normal schedule. I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to going back next year. but I also look forward to getting back to a normal pace for the show. And this has been, of course, episode 146. I want to thank our sponsor for the episode, Noble Knight Games, for their support, and I also want to thank our guests, Quinn Murphy, Mike Shea, and Fistful of Comics and Games. You can find links to all of their various sites in the show notes. Email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com, visit the forums at vorpalnetwork.com, and of course, do not forget to call up the Tomes Biz line at 919-BIZ-TOME. Our next episode is going to be looking at Dark Sun. If you have comments, questions, or thoughts that you want to share about Dark Sun, please call up 919-BIZ-TOME. Other than that, we'll be talking about Essentials next month and possibly discussing Psionic Power with one of the authors. So if you have questions about Psionic Power, I'd love to hear those too. 919-BIZ-TOME. Also, make sure you get out there and help spread the word about the show. I can only do so much after all these years to help spread the word. I've hit most of the corners I know to hit of the internet. So now I have to count on you guys to get out there and help me. Go, Tome Army! Conquer the interwebs! And, of course, don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps us pay our bills. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. In this episode, I have sent my minions out into the world of Gen Con, where they conquered, divided, and now control the entire exhibit hall floor, which sadly has been empty for several weeks now. In this, episode 146, Gen Con interviews of...
I'm on the wall.